Hello and welcome to LedgerCast, a podcast about the cryptocurrency and blockchain space. If you enjoy this episode, you can rate us on iTunes and also leave us a review. We really appreciate that. I have a special co-host today, Nick Pispie. Nick's a veteran of the cryptocurrency space. He's been involved since 2012. We dig into his story and we talk about some of the macroeconomic aspects of cryptocurrency. And then we dig into smart contracts and really go in depth about how smart contracts and the platforms around smart contracts affect the overall crypto ecosystem, how Nick looks at investments and other stuff like that. I think it's a lot of fun and I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of LedgerCast. I have a special co-host today with me, Nick Pispie. Is that how you pronounce it?
Pispie, you know it.
Nick Pispie. You may know Nick. He's a crypto veteran. He's stepping in for Josh today. So, Nick, I appreciate you doing that, and it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, man. Look forward to it.
Yeah. So, today we're going to focus on smart contract platforms, but we're going to start off like we normally do with news of the week and stuff like that. It's been a fun week in crypto, like always. Nick, has anything in particular stood out to you? I know we can talk about some of the big price action, but is there anything in addition to that that you've seen this week that caught your attention?
Biggest thing probably fundamentally for Bitcoin specifically would be the launch of Rootstock and the realization of smart contracts coming to Bitcoin finally.
So what's the genesis of Rootstock?
The genesis of Rootstock is essentially, you know, they've always been Bitcoin supporters, but they noticed that it was just lacking the functionality of the smart contracts, and they wanted to bring that technology to Bitcoin and not have the users to have to go somewhere else.
Cool. So this is obviously something that's being tested from them or by them, but it's not something that would be like part of Bitcoin core for a very long time, if ever, right?
Right. It runs on like separately of Bitcoin on its own layer. I believe it's on the Omni layer. Correct me if I'm wrong. But they've had a testnet live, I believe, since the summertime. Like this technology, they've been testing it for a long time. It's not just came out of the blue or something. It's been a long time coming. It's been a lot of community support around it, and we can finally, you know, start pumping out additional layers and functionality to Bitcoin beyond the current store of value use that it's in speculation that it's being used for.
Cool, that's interesting, and that will go well into our primary topic. And actually, I forgot before we get moving on other stuff. Where do you come from in terms of your the short version of your Bitcoin story? How did you get into all this in the first place?
My friend originally had like showed me it back in 2011, and I never really took much interest at the time because I had a well-paying job in the oil fields. And then in 2012, I was, you know, in between jobs, and I took another look at the Bitcoin thing because the price was starting to move again. And I heard this guy on, I can't recall the exact name, on YouTube, and he was talking about potential applications of this technology, and he was actually getting into smart contracts. And that was the original talk that really got me like, this could be interesting. This could change a lot of things, right? Like, so I went down the rabbit hole and eventually bought my first Bitcoin pretty much at the top in 2012. And I didn't care. Like, obviously, yeah, everyone wants to make money and everything, right? But for me, it was more so, okay, I'm ready to dive into this and get some skin in the game. Because once you have skin in the game, you care about it a little bit more, right? You're going to put more time into it. You've basically incentivized you to take the next step, right? And I think that's where a lot of people that are currently struggling am I going to pull that trigger or not, right? But once you finally do, then you kind of, you'll have your dads and your aunts and uncles who now they're starting to get interested in it. So I think the best way to get people involved is just give them a little bit of Bitcoin, really, because then they're going to have invested interest in it. And I think that's fantastic. More people that are in this, the more people that know about it, then the better it is for all of our investments in the world, really.
When you say you were interested in the smart contracts, was that a well-developed idea at the time? Because
not at all. There was Ethereum was didn't even there's nothing around that technology that existed yet. It was this guy basically just talking and seeing the applications of how the blockchain and this technology could be leveraged in other ways other than being used as a currency, as many people saw Bitcoin back then, right?
As a, and in that sense, as a currency, meaning a spendable one, not like a, not the store of value framework that people are really pushing more today.
And I think the store of value argument is kind of just taken front seat now, just because the fees are so high. It's not really feasible to use Bitcoin as a currency in its current state. I'm not saying it doesn't develop a different layer or someone doesn't develop another technology that we don't see yet. And that's kind of my point here, is that just because something doesn't exist now doesn't mean that it's going to A, stay that way, and B, not exist in the future, right? Like, how many people could predict transferring video, storing music, transferring gigabytes of data through on the internet, right? So I think it's important that people really get the larger perspective of things and see how young these technologies are, right? And again, like, I was excited for what didn't exist then, and you know, it's the exact same thing today. I have no clue what people are going to be developing in the future and all these crazy applications. I know what I think it can be used for and what I would like to see, especially in supply chain management, because, you know, it makes up 2/3 of the global GDP. And so there's just immense room for disruption. And the market, like, yeah, we can talk about market caps and speculation on price till we go blue in the face, but a lot of these applications aren't, they're not just for financial products or financial gain. They're literally going to change and modernize and remove the bureaucracy and inefficiencies in all these current systems and institutions that exist today. And that's what's so great about blockchain and Bitcoin, is that it's flexible, it's malleable, and we can take these layers, these systems, and transcribe them over the existing systems. They don't need to necessarily replace them, right? And that's what Hal Finney, one of the original Bitcoin developers, said in his
post. Also maybe Satoshi.
Right? Like, exactly. I love the speculation. Well, we'll never know, or at least we don't know now. But he said that Bitcoin isn't meant to replace banks. And I take that as Bitcoin doesn't need to replace these systems, right? The systems themselves aren't the problem. It's the people and the lack of accountability and trust that's the problem in these systems. But Bitcoin and blockchain technology, it forces all the participants on that network and of the technology by virtue to be trustworthy and accountable, right? If you're not, then you're kicked out of the system. You're kicked out of the network. You can't participate in it, right? So that's what's really groundbreaking of this technology. It's just its flexibility and adaptability to what exists already without having to necessarily remove or completely disrupt it.
How did you find yourself getting more skin in the game as time went on? Like, you're basically full-time doing things within this ecosystem now, right? So how did you evolve to that point from doing whatever you were doing before?
Yeah, so originally I had built myself a little life raft. I didn't just quit my job with, you know, nothing in the bank. I had, you know, $10,000-$15,000 to live off for a little while, and I lived cheaply. Like, it's the classic story of $300-$500 a month. Play as much as you, little as you can, right? Because this thing is going to be huge. Save your Bitcoin now, live off credit. Was essentially, or my parents basically in that case. And that was the right strategy. I have no regrets. I have no shame around it. I bet other people wish they could have done it.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Right, I'm very grateful that I was given the opportunity. I see it as an opportunity to have that support system in place to allow to support Bitcoin, me during when Bitcoin was low, and for them to believe in what I saw, that this eventually would pay off in the end. And, you know, I always had the idea that it would be, you know, up until 2020, 7-year mark would be a good time indicator of, well, is this thing going to be something or not, right? And obviously, it's accelerated beyond my expectations by a few years, so that's fantastic. But essentially, as soon as I got involved with this, got my first Bitcoin, I quit my job, I went full-time full-time into this. I've poured more than 30,000 hours into this since then, and I've been full-time for almost 6 years now. So originally I was just doing trading with Bitcoin, and then I got into the altcoins back in 2014, 2015, even 2013. And back then it was a lot different than it was now, right? The liquidity in the market was a lot shallower. The top 10 coins, like you could be in the top 100 and have a market cap of, you could just be in the top 100. There wasn't even that many coins back then, for Christ's sakes, right?
The top 100 was the entire ecosystem.
Exactly. Like the top 100, you could be in there with like 100, 200,000 market cap. And now you can't even be in the top 100 without $200 million market cap. So it kind of gives you a comparison of how fast this has really grown. Like it's just the order of magnitude. It just still astonishes me. It's amazing. And I've been expecting it this entire time and I'm still flabbergasted.
Yeah. Are you a believer in the S-curve adoption thing that a lot of people put out there?
Big time, big time. And the reason why I think people should pay attention to that is because our systems and distribution systems for information via the internet, for example, has accelerated the spread of good and bad ideas, right? So the more and more people that come online, again, it's just a network effect. The more people that participate, the more valuable it becomes, right? The more people that come online and have access to the internet, then the quicker the S-curve of adoptions of new technologies will be. So, Andreas Antonopoulos had a great talk on saying it took about, 600 years for people to get used to the idea of switching from using coins to taking the IOUs that they were giving, right? So basically paper money. And then it took about a magnitude of 10 times less that amount of time to move and for people to get familiar and, start to trust and use credit cards from using fiat, right? So the question is, how long is it going to take for people to make the same transition towards digital currencies? And I think it's going to be a lot sooner and more disruptive than what we've seen in the past and what people are expecting. Because clearly every traditional economist has been wrong up to this point, because they're trying, in my opinion, they're trying to use old evaluation models that don't really take into account network effect. I think that's the real ingredient for judging how valuable these things are and could be.
Do you think there's a direct correlation between adoption and price, or do you think the S-curve of adoption, say we get to the point where 80% of society is using digital currencies in their everyday lives, that can be independent of price? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, because there's a lot of calls for this big crash, but there's this potential also for it just to level off, like it's the parabola of growth. Maybe it has to break, but maybe it doesn't, like maybe it just levels. I don't know. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I don't think, like, obviously the more people that are involved, then, the more money that's coming into the ecosystem. So the higher the price it should go. But at the same time, if we understand and accept that the majority of wealth is controlled by the few, then I guess it's more so about the quality of people that you're bringing in terms of their financial capability and resources behind them, right? So if you get 10 guys in and they have $10 billion, that's a hell of a lot of velocity of money coming into the ecosystem versus, say, 10 million people with only $1 each. What would you rather have as your business, right?
Hmm.
So I think Bitcoin is going to continue to experience a bottom-up type growth, and that's obviously good for the further decentralization and distribution of the network and Bitcoin as a whole. But the money is not going to come from the bottom up, in my opinion. It's going to come from top down, from institutions, old money, etc. Right? Like Bitcoin is the perfect hedge, and I think Andreas, again, he was one of the guys I went to very early on to learn as much as I could about this. And he went on to use the analogy of, well, imagine we've been on this highway this entire time, and generally about every 10 years there's a financial crisis. And it's worth noting that central banks were kind of put in place and given a mandate to prevent that, But since then, you know, they continue to happen. And you could argue that it's orchestrated by them and their poor policy, right? And the people managing it, etc. But generally, you've never been able to get off that highway through every financial crash. And a lot of these times, these crashes or events can be predicted, right? So, but there's no other way for you to get out of the way for the average person. So up and now you enter Bitcoin and you can see the crash that, like, you can see the burning cars ahead. Like, we know what's coming, right? And now people actually have, oh, thank God, there's the offshoot. There's the off-ramp. We can get off now. Let's go on the Bitcoin highway. Oh, it's perfect. It's nothing but rainbows, right? So my point here is that people have a choice for like literally one of the first times that I can think of in history to avoid all of this. And I think that's huge.
Yeah, that's interesting. We'll get into the primary topic of getting back to smart contracts. But one of the questions that we got was on game theory of what does happen with Bitcoin if another financial crisis hits like the one that happened in 2008, or I guess even a more modest one like what we saw in 2001, 1992 or whatever it was. Like, these happen, like you said, every 10 years. So
from a math point of view, if we acknowledge that the rising debt levels are unsustainable, then the crises just get worse and worse because they're just using gasoline, i.e. printing more money, to throw it on a debt on problem caused by debt, right? And we're entering an era where I think we're going to see a lot of inflationary events around the world in currencies. And for countries to remain competitive with their exports, right, then that means they're going to have to devalue their currencies. And we're kind of already seeing that, you know, in China and in other places. But I think that's going to accelerate, and that's going to it's going to give the perfect narrative for Bitcoin. Like, even what's happening now, like, wow, it's the perfect dream for what we could be imagining. All this uncertainty, the turmoil, North Korea, all that stuff, all that fear narrative that the media has been pumping out just plays right into these hands, right? So yeah, I think Bitcoin definitely prospers in these conditions and continued conditions.
There's a website that I like called isthestockmarketgoingtocrash.com. And it has statistics between, I think they only go back to 2005. It's a diamond of economic failure. And as these four primary metrics that they calculate, market overvaluation, public debt, market volatility, and household debt, as those extend to the edges, it increases the risk of a market failure or economy crashing. And in 2008, it was interesting because the market volatility was the highest it had ever been, and household debt was the highest it had ever been. And that's shifted dramatically now to where market volatility is the lowest it's ever been, and market overvaluation, meaning the price of the stock market cumulative as a ratio to GDP, and it's like 136% right now. And public debt is incredibly high. So we almost completely overcorrected from household debt and market volatility to the other side of the spectrum. And one of the things it says is volatility is can be like, it's very low right now. And volatility is one of those things that's like, it's really, really low until it's not. creates an explosive event.
Yep.
You
hammered the issue on the head, in my opinion. That the problem is the household debt. You know, governments tax, or in Canada, governments the federal government collects money from the province, and a lot of provinces have huge provincial debts, and they're struggling to pay that via through the taxpayers, right? And the taxpayers, they're getting bled dry as well, and they've had to take on ever-increasing amounts of debt. You know, Canadian household debt ratio is at 165%. So it doesn't take much rise in interest rates or extra payments that come out of nowhere to put a lot of pressure on these borrowers, right? So it's not at critical levels now in terms of are people walking away from their mortgages? It's not there yet. But the point is that there's the warning signs are there. Like, people should be vigilant about this stuff and not expect the merry-go-round to continue to be so merry or going around, right? Eventually, the math speaks for itself and it comes to roost.
I've also seen the current buildup described as the everything bubble versus like the housing bubble.
Right. You got student debt. You got auto loans debt. You got the government debt, retail debt, all at very high levels. So if these low interest rate environments don't continue, and you know, in Canada, for example, they're definitely not going to be continue to be down here. The government here in BC, for example, is already, they've put in new mortgage laws of January 1st that requires people for a stress test to see if they can handle interest rates rising a couple percent, right? And the majority can't because wages have never kept up with the rate of inflation, right? And all these liberal movements for like, you know, the fight for 15 and stuff, that's not going to get you anything. In fact, you're going to lose out, and they already are. It's kind of funny. You're going to lose more than what you're going to gain. So for example, in Ontario, the Tim Hortons company, which isn't even Canadian, by the way, like that's just, again, a huge narrative spin, right? Again, everything is just about controlling narrative and marketing. That's it. If you can convince people of something, it doesn't matter if it's real. You've already convinced them. So you got what you wanted. The engineering is complete.
I actually just saw, you mentioned the auto loan debt. Just in the past couple of days, some new statistics have come out that auto loan debts or defaults are reaching the similar levels. And it's like 1/30th, I think, the market size of what household debt is, but it's, or like mortgage debt. But it's reaching the same alarming default rates as we reached with mortgage debt before 2008. So it's fascinating to me.
The warning signs are there, and let's just wait for the pop and see where everything lies. Again, I'll refer back to Andreas. We do not want everything popping at once all around the world because that's just super chaotic. It's super. It's very tough to recover stability from that. But isolated crashes, for example, what we're seeing in Venezuela, easy thing to point to, those are manageable, right? But if you have everything burning at the same time, just like a forest fire, it's like, what do? Well, you got to let it burn out because you don't got the resources to help everything.
It's a terrifying thought when you think this is humanity at stake, but that's certainly the logical way to see it.
And if you can't ride out the storm, like what's the point of owning Bitcoin or any of these things if all the services and like, goods and services or supply chains are all down, right? So plan for the worst ahead of time before it's. I hear this great adage, and it says buy Bitcoin when you can, not when you need to.
That's fascinating. One of the things I think maybe representative of the market's desire for something different is the rapid increase of users we've seen going into crypto. Of course, there's a lot of speculative bubble talk there, but it's hard to deny the fact that we're seeing hundreds of thousands of new users per day on these exchanges, actually on several exchanges. I think I saw that Binance got 250,000 new users in one day.
They've closed new user and they've also, interestingly enough, I just looked at it today, they've also closed new coin submissions.
Oh, have they?
They're completely swamped.
Yeah. Binance and Bittrex have both closed new registrations. So like if you want to sign up for altcoins, and I think within the same day, because the flood was so quickly transferred to Cryptopia, they also closed theirs. So the flood of new users we're seeing is significant, and they're not just going to Bitcoin, they're going to everything. And that feeds into the additional news we've seen the past couple of weeks, and we don't have to talk about specifics, but we've seen significant shakeups even in the top 10 of market cap within cryptocurrencies, including a 10x USD value increase in Ripple, in Stellar. Ethereum has seen a 3-4x move over the past couple of months in USD. We're just seeing massive amounts of money coming in. I think we hit 700 billion market cap.
We are currently at 768, but it makes sense. You know, look at the 24-hour volume. It's $61.7 billion.
Rather than getting into specifics of like what's going, which coins are doing what, I think it's just worth noting the rapid increase we've seen. And my personal speculation, maybe you agree, would be that we'll continue to see these double-digit percentage increases in market cap, at least for the next several months, I think. It seems like 2018 is going to be a wild year in terms of that.
I agree with that. And the reason why I agree with that is because right now the data doesn't suggest that anything's slowing down. So it's very difficult to try and predict tops and bottoms, you know, in markets. But this is something, it's a freight train you don't want to be standing in front of when you hear those type of user onboarding numbers, right? For example, people, when do you get bearish on Bitcoin is a common question. Well, I'll tell you. You get bearish on Bitcoin when you see the network effects starting to slow down. You get bearish on Bitcoin when you can start looking at the amount of users that are coming in, and that's taking like 10, 20% decreases month on month. That's when you know things are slowing down and it's probably time to take a break or something. But until then, until the data says otherwise, don't be the hero trying to speculate a top, because odds are you're just going to be wrong.
People often use economic freedom or monetary reasons for why crypto is important. But there's the other angle that I think Silicon Valley is certainly embracing strongly, but also others, which is applying underlying technologies that were the basis of Bitcoin with the blockchain itself, and applying that to every industry. You mentioned supply chain, but literally everything, real estate, banking, whatever. So that gets us into this primary topic of smart contract platforms, why they're important, what role that plays in the entire ecosystem, and what are the who are the big players?
It's important because of the automation that it creates. And again, we basically operate on a series of social contracts in all our in our life, right?
So like cutting out the middleman is an example of what you mean, right? Between automating these social contracts.
Fill the work or run away with the money or trust on the other side of that, that the person is going to pay you the money, right? Like the terms and conditions are both agreed upon ahead of time and the money's put in an escrow. There's no room for, you know, funniness. The only problem with this, like it's all great on paper and when we talk about it, but again, it's another thing to actually develop it and then put it out into the real world. Like a lot of the time as a developer or engineer or an inventor, you create something, you have an idea of how you want to see it used or maybe how you think other people will use it. But in the end, until it actually gets out there, you never really know, right? You can, yeah. And a lot of inventors, they'll make stuff that they absolutely despise in the end. Like the guy who made the shopping center, like the modern mall, for example, he envisioned it as a place, a communal place where people could go and there was like really integrated with like, you know, the nature and things and be more a communal thing. But the corporate America, you know, took that and just concrete pavement everywhere, right? They really just made it a retail space for commerce and like high endorphins and feelings and just really fast pace and pretty much the exact opposite of what this guy had envisioned. So he died really hating what his invention had become. So again, we don't know how smart contracts will look in the next 5 years, right? We've already seen catastrophic failures of this technology, right? And it's worth noting, like put a disclaimer on everything, beta, for the next few years at least, right?
Yeah, and beta is a nice term. Alpha is likely.
There you go. That's much better. But yeah, like the technology and the ideas, it's proven, the proof of concept is there. Now we just need to fine tune it. And
I don't know about you, but when I describe crypto stuff to friends and family, I might get somewhere talking about like financial sovereignty and escaping nationalist currencies. I get further when I start describing application of the blockchain in other realms. I think that connects with people that have gotten more accustomed to technological revolution, but people who are not accustomed to more ideological revolution, if you will.
I think they care a little bit more if they understood actually how money works and it's created, right? So essentially, like, here's the proposition, right? For every dollar that we borrow, and we borrow everything when it's created, there's interest attached to it. So the amount owed is always greater than the amount in circulation and being created. That alone should be like, what? Like, why are we using that, right? That doesn't make sense, right? So once you understand that, and then you move into, well, you never own your money, right? It's the same thing. If you don't own your private keys, you don't really own your Bitcoin. It's the same concept here with your fiat. You think you have ownership of your money in the bank account, but you don't. If you say or do something that that corporation or government doesn't like, they're going to lock your funds. And without money, you're not a person, because you can't live. I don't know anyone who lives without money. Eventually, you have to panhandle it. You have to borrow it.
There is a primitive technology channel on YouTube that I find fascinating. If we go full nuclear, that guy has created everything from stuff in the woods in Australia.
Such a small population that do this, it's not really viable in terms of like keeping society sure. running.
When we look at what's out there now, and you mentioned how this is on a testnet for Bitcoin itself, but so far...
It's on mainnet now.
Okay. But over the past year or two, the majority of experiments have occurred on Ethereum.
Yeah.
I think when you talk about smart contracts, most people are going to start by talking about Ethereum. So I think it's worth discussing how did Ethereum become the go-to option so far? And do you have any thoughts on where we go from here? Because when we talk about altcoins, hundreds of them are created on the premise of either replacing or improving Ethereum, right?
Right. I think Ethereum just has the first mover advantage. And it has the branding that people are familiar with. So it's built some trust with people, right? And that's huge. Obviously, some competitors in this space, it's easy to come in and look at your competition or look at Ethereum and see maybe mistakes they've made or maybe something you'd do something differently. So you can come out with a competing product relatively quick. Now, we can get into some of the names there, for example, like Neo, Ubiquity. Some of these things we've even heard of, right? EOS is a big one. Urbit, like, we can forward this list to your list.
Tezos.
Yeah, Tezos, Rootstock, Lisk, you know, Bitcoin now with...
Ubic, my personal favorite. Are we shilling our bags?
Counterparty, another one before. The point is, yeah, there's a lot of options out there. But we, as we were saying before, we don't know what this technology is really going to... like. It's better just to take a bet on all of them at this point, in my opinion, and diversify. Because one of them will be what people congregate towards. I think what's going to happen is there's going to be a centralization effect around a lot of these services and around certain coins, similar to how there's really only one big social media giant. There's really only one big search thing that people use, right? There's only one big online distributor, Amazon, Google.
When you say centralization around some of these, do you mean also in terms of how a particular one is controlled, as in like Vitalik owns a lot of Ethereum or something like that? Or
no, I guess what I mean centralization when I say that is the centralization of the users. The users will centralize around a service.
A standard.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. Eventually, some product is going to offer just be clearly superior. So why would you use X or the other competition, right? They may stick around, but I don't see them getting widely used. And, you know, the less people that use something, if we understand that these are, again, network effects, then the less valuable it just becomes intrinsically, right?
Mm-hmm. When you approach these from a trading perspective, do you look at them long term? Like, you want to make a bet on one that could dethrone Ethereum and you will maintain that bet for years? Or do you look at them more short term, like... relative to them being a quality trade against Bitcoin or something like that?
Yeah, so I manage my portfolio in two different portfolios for different things. So I have my long-term bets where I just divert to, you know, so for example, take 10 Bitcoin, pump one Bitcoin each. It's like a classic VC strategy, right? Just pepper everything. Eventually something's going to go moonshot and make up for all the other ones that didn't, right? And so I've kind of taken that approach to a lot of these, the space at this time, because again, you don't know who's going to be the winner. Like, of course we could speculate and everyone has their favorite coin, but that's just emotional bias and you're invested in something. So of course you think that's going to be the right one, right? But
right.
Yeah, so there's a difference in like actually what, and I think we have to ask the question, what's long-term? I ask, yeah, or what's an investor? Like, a lot of the time these people are like, oh, I'm investing in altcoins. I'm like, interesting. So how long?
For the next like week.
Right. So like they're throwing out these concepts and these ideas, these names, and really they have no clue what they're talking about, right? So they're trying to apply these strategies that are meant for long term or short term, and they're using it on the vice versa. So of course they're going to run into issues like that. But if you're just trading off on intraday or something, you know, just trying to catch the swings and the fluctuations and capitalize on the speculation, then you need to be trading on shorter time frames. You need to be looking at it, you know, if you're on the 3-day or the 2-day, for example, look for that multi-week move, right? Don't just get into a position, then flip it an hour later for a couple percent gain.
I think what we're seeing with that too is when you have 5% volatility as like a pretty calm 24-hour period, that encourages behavior to catch a 50% 3-day swing or something like that, and rolling that over to the next 50% or 100% 3-day swing. So people are not looking at the space and saying, well, what might outpace Bitcoin over the next year by 2 to 3 times? And instead, they're looking at it and saying, well, what's going to outpace Bitcoin over the next 2 days by, 50%, and let's compound that over and over again. And it's a viable strategy, but it's also a dangerous one.
And a lot of these people, like, in order to be fluid in this space, you have to commit your life to it, like, because this stuff moves so fast. And the reason why it moves so fast is because, again, it's digital, it's network. Like, it's just like why software develops quicker than hardware, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can deploy it quicker. It can be produced faster. It's less, the testing is less resource intensive. It is, you don't have to manufacture. Like, you remove the manufacturing process altogether, right? And that's just a huge time saver. The turnover rates are much quicker. So it's, people come in here with these short mindsets, and they're willing, you know, still working their 9-to-5 job, and they expect to kill it. And in reality, you're not going to kill it. You're going to kill your account with that strategy. So I think it's better.
Certainly relative to Bitcoin, maybe not relative to the dollar.
Oh yeah, I think the dollar is just, you know, going down the tube long term. That's my personal view. Don't take trading advice off that. I think I think people just need to switch their mindset and be, even the data supports it. Like, the buy and hold strategy for a solid coin with a solid team behind it that are actively developing and are transparent and, like, you know, they're communicating what they're doing. Those coins it's a better strategy just to buy and hold those type of coins with those teams and actual products behind them than it is trying to chase these random 50%, 60% swings in XXXY coin, right? Like, you'd never, people aren't doing their fundamental research, and then eventually they're going to get burned.
So when someone gets interested in whether it's a smart contract platform or anything, and you start showing them things that aren't in the top 10 market cap or aren't in the top 100 market cap, I think that can make people very nervous. However, if you're looking for return, like looking for something that's a promising platform, and I do want to stick to smart contracts as much as we can, like, how do we look for something that's a smart contract platform or anything and say, this looks like a viable bet? Like, what are you looking for as something that might be standing out from Ethereum? Is it governance models, or is it the code base, or like, what kind of things play into your own mindset?
So for any type of pick that I'm looking at long term or even short term, it's the same criteria for everything. And that's A, do they have a working functional product? Right? If they do, check it off the list. Number two, do they got a team that's professional? Do they got a proven track record behind them of success? Right? You're going to want to bet. People like to bet on the winners, right? And that's, you know, same thing here, right? And are there names out there? Are they transparent, right? That's becoming more of a thing. I know like Bitcoin Satoshi, who knows who he is. But for a lot of these new projects, and since there's competing projects out there, this is just, again, my criteria of what I want to look for. I want to be able to communicate with that team. I think that's one thing that's really unique about this space is that, for example, I can go talk to the, I can get access to these you know, the creators of these coins, the CEOs of these companies, and they're happy to discuss things. I can't go get a call with Tim Cook at Apple, right? Larry Page or any of those guys. So this space is a lot more accessible, even to the average user, right? Like, you just reach out on social media and most of these teams will get back to you.
Do you find it concerning if something's meant to be used as a decentralized network, if there's a team in control of a large percentage of the coin supply?
Yeah, I think there's always an inherent risk behind it, because now you're just, we're having to then just go back to what we're trying to get away from, and that's having to trust people in the first place with these transactions or your data, right? So yeah, I definitely think there's it creates like a risk and a knife that can hang over your investment. And that's why if they are keeping coins, one of the next criteria checkboxes is to see if there's lockup periods, are there vesting periods, and if so, like what's the release rate, how much do they get access, do they have to hit milestones, right? Like, pretty standard in, like, you know, your corporations today, right? Like, everything's really transparent, you know when they're going to be selling, etc. So I look for that type of built-in protection. If I don't see any of that, I completely avoid it, because the risk is too great, and there's 100 other coins that are trying to do what you're going to do. So you're either going to cater to what the people want, or the people just aren't going to choose you. Like, that's what's so great about all this. It's opt-in, it's voluntary. Nobody's forcing you to buy these coins.
One of the things that I differentiate between, and maybe this is not a great way to look at it, I'm not sure. If I'm looking at a coin that's trying to be a currency, whether it's a transactional currency, store value, I don't know what, versus a coin that's trying to be a platform or it's a network protocol or something, to me that makes a difference in terms of what I want from leadership and how much I care about their incentives or their stake by having coins themselves and that kind of thing. So for example, like a Litecoin, where Charlie Lee no longer owns any, that's better to me than if, like, something that's trying to be a platform layer and has a corporation behind it for smart contracts. I kind of want them to be more invested, you know, like for a currency, it makes me a little worried. Like, I don't necessarily want one person to be in total control of Litecoin as a transactional currency. But that level of leadership or project direction that can come from a corporate entity or foundation or something for a contracts platform, I am kind of drawn to. Do you think that's a bad thing or?
No, I completely agree with that. Different governance models for different use cases, right? That's basically what I have to say about that. I agree completely. You know, a lot of people say when Charlie Lee cashed out, he cashed out from a game theory perspective, his interests were no longer aligned with the public, right? But if you look at, like, for example, Intel, like the CEO there, he's mandated to hold X amount of stock, right, in the company. So his interests are aligned with his investors, right? But Charlie Lee, like, his actions over the past, you know, 5 years or even 7 years, however old Litecoin is, should speak volumes rather than him just cashing out the coins. There's no reason not to believe that he's going to continue to work on the project or in what capacity he has already committed to, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. If someone has a history of doing so, then to me it's not as much of a concern.
Yeah, you got to give him the benefit of the doubt to some degree.
One of the questions we have gotten, and it fits into the conversation nicely, I think, is whether a lot of altcoins, and maybe it's a contract platform or maybe it's a token of some sort, why they need to exist as a token or currency itself, and why they can't utilize Bitcoin or maybe a more transactional coin as the token of exchange and instead exist as a protocol layer of sorts, and how that would even fit or work in the crypto space.
Right. And I think I'm glad you brought that up, because that kind of takes me back to the next checkbox on the criteria list. Does this thing need a blockchain? Like, are they using it for the technology to actually solve a legitimate problem, and a blockchain is a viable solution? Or are they just using it for a buzzword and they're looking to cash in on their hype, and maybe their idea doesn't really need a blockchain at all. In fact, it just adds complexity.
How do we squeeze a blockchain into this solution?
Right, exactly, because they just want to get funded, right? Everyone thinks their idea is number one and it's going to change the world. But, you know, in reality, that doesn't happen most of the time. And most ideas aren't good or going to change the world. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing here, right? People are just capitalizing on this gold rush. And it's important. You need to look at the problem. They need to present you with a problem. You need to understand that problem and agree that, yeah, this is an issue. Okay. Now then you have to look at, okay, now let's see what their solution is. Okay, this is their solution, and this is why they think a blockchain would be good, right? And if you cannot surmise why they need a blockchain, or you disagree that it needs a blockchain, then you should probably avoid the project.
Do you think that an equity-based solution is one of the premier positive use cases for smart contracts? So like fundraising right now that exists on Kickstarter, for instance, like could provide actual equity to people that funded a project to a layman investor. Do you think that's a good use of a smart contract system?
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic use. And we just have to, because you're any smart contract or any system that you can create with built-in incentive mechanisms I guess that'd be another incentive, but reason to hold it, right? You're just creating incentive to hold it. You can do that whether it be through equity or maybe like governance, you can have votes or something, right? I definitely think those are perfect applications for smart contract technology. But, you know, right now it's still very new and we're going through the regulatory hurdles. And a lot of that stuff, it is a security. It gets labeled as a security because that's what it is, right? And a lot of it, yeah. a lot of these projects, they'll try and avoid the terms, they'll call it utility, etc. But really, you're just like repainting the kettle a different color. It's still a kettle, right? But my prediction is that a lot of these projects are going to just accept that they're utilities. All the ICOs coming out, like you have Polymath, for example, that's literally a securities token platform, right? I think we're going to be seeing a couple competitors similar to Polymath moving forward. And I think the majority of ICOs moving forward are just going to embrace it because those incentive mechanisms and those governance structures and creates a lot of value. And it's a really easy way to build early network effect. And that's probably the hardest thing to do is build that early network. It's a similar thing to getting your first 1,000 or 2,000 followers on Twitter. It's the hardest part. But once you have that, it kind of just takes care of itself, right? Like word travels, etc. And that's another checkbox on the list of how you should look on when evaluating if you should get into a project. Does it have a network effect? Are people actually using this thing, right? Because if they're not, there's a problem. Like there has to be, there's something wrong with it, or you really are like super early, like good for you. But I'm not looking to get in at the first user. I want to see some validity behind it. I want to see the thing actually working, because for myself, it's not, capital preservation is just as important as growth. Eventually you get to a point where you want to protect what you have, right? It's a similar to once you build the castle, what do you want to do? You want to protect the castle. So you build moats and hire armies and security, right? So it's the same thing with investing. Once you have a nice stack, say $100,000, $1 million, just whatever the number is, you just want to protect it and you're a lot more diligent with it, right?
One of the questions was from Kevin Rogers, and I think we answered this a little bit, but I'm curious if you have additional thoughts because of the one at hand, was just to discuss the impact of a centralized company. He used the example of Ripple and how they impact a crypto ecosystem that favors decentralization. So do you have additional thoughts when you talk about teams, if you apply it to a company that's like strictly a private product company like Ripple that has a open source network token?
Yeah, well, I think there's still a lot of debate and speculation in the air into the actual use of the XRP token itself and of who is using and who's using it now, the Ripple network itself, and who they say are going to be using it. There's a lot of, from media that they're coming out with is, oh yeah, well, partnerships are coming. we can't name any names, but, you know, people will be using this thing. That signals, okay, so they're not right now.
Yeah, there was actually a big article about this just like yesterday, I think. The type of thing that you, if you are doing one of these investments, it's worth knowing your risks when you get into it.
That point here is that people, no one really understands the stuff well enough to be able to come out and say, okay, this is exactly what it does. This is exactly what they're using, right? Like, what was it? Vitalik was, when he was debating whether Craig White was Satoshi or not, there's two ways you can do things. And one's the easy way, and it's just to come out, provide proof, and yep, this is how we do it. Or you could do the other way, and that's just complexity and, like, you know, come up with excuses and add words in there and phrases so that it just confuses your user rather than provides any clarity. Most of the time, that's bullshit, right? And I kind of get that feeling from what I'm looking on how XRP is handling this, but also they're a private company, right? They keep a lot of information secret for
competitive reasons.
Right, exactly. So I think it Ripple's overvalued right now, but at the same time, as a trader, and you can see on my public feed, like I'd love to buy some Ripple, right? Like under point two, look prime. And but I'm since out of Ripple, besides my little long term position, just in case, right? And again, it always let something run. Just in case. Yeah. You never know, right? And I think that's the greatest takeaway from all of this is you never want to be completely out of something unless it really is dead, like, you know, BitConnect or any of the other Ponzi schemes, UTI Tech that just blew up as well, right? You don't want to be left holding the bag there, but, you know, it has billions of dollars circulating into it right now, has huge media hype, it has the retail hype right now. So I think it's really naive just to think that it's just going to go flat back to zero, right? It's just in a cycle. It's in a cycle.
On the application of smart contracts, do you have an industry that you think will be first or will be most welcoming to essentially putting blockchain and smart contracts to use?
It's impossible to say which one's going to move first. I know that I'm excited for, you know, trust funds to be set up into this, wills, mm-hmm. all that stuff, deeds, any type of transference of, you know, goods or wealth exactly over a set amount of time. Like time-locked smart contracts are going to be awesome. Like that functionality is really cool. Again, I think smart contracts are going to completely revolutionize the supply chain industry. Like a lot of the costs, I just started looking into this stuff. And I'll link some great talks on this topic to your listeners after you can hopefully provide. And a lot of the cost is just the bureaucracy. And, like, you know, to move that thing of corn to your plate, you're dealing with 16, 20 companies or intermediaries in between. And every time it's similar to Bitcoin, how a Bitcoin transaction is created and sent out. For every input or every move, got a Bitcoin price alarm going off there, new highs, here we go, baby. There's a cost associated with it, right? Everyone's taking that middleman cost. So when you have 16 to 20 middlemen in between that plate, grain of rice in your plate, the costs are tremendous from a supply chain perspective. So I think smart contracts are going to remove a lot of that inefficiency and make it a lot cheaper.
That's one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by projects that are focusing on areas with lower regulation barriers. So like people looking in Africa, for instance, and using blockchain and smart contracts there anywhere with a better regulation environment to allow certain things to exist, I think is fascinating. And I think it might be one of the hindrances to North America being able to take advantage of some of this stuff.
The amount of corruption over there as well. Again, it forces all the participants to be honest and accountable, right? Not to themselves, because clearly they're not, but to the smart contract and the other person on the side of that deal, right? So it cuts costs, removes the corruption factor, but it's just getting people on board using the thing, right? That's probably going to be the most difficult. But again, like, from a business perspective, why aren't you going to be using it if you know you can cut, you know, 20, 25% of your costs?
Someone with a great Twitter handle, their username is Pray for Dip. They asked, what's one of the unexpected insights that you gained by getting into crypto? So what's something that you learned that you would not have expected to have learned or gotten into?
I think the behavior of people, like, and the psychology of what goes behind people's decisions and how they react. And I think a great field that gets into this is behavioral economics. And that's something, like, I love psychology. I love social engineering. I think everyone can be manipulated and everyone is manipulated through media. And it's just interesting to see how even the smartest person can get duped into something, right? With, as long as something's phrased a certain way, right? It's right. It's all about how you present things, right?
Yeah, I mentioned this to you before, but I listened to Freakonomics, and it's a podcast about economics and behavioral psychology that fits perfectly in line with that. And NPR's Planet Money does a good job with it too. They usually pick a topic, and sometimes there's a psychological component, but I definitely have to agree that psychology, and especially as I see it play out where the person asking me the question or whatever has no idea that I'm looking at it in a particular perspective, like, you know, Bitcoin broke 10,000, now I'll buy it type of stuff.
Like, I know, to us it seems like, why would you, like, we've been telling you since $100 you should be buying this. But again, yeah, people like to bet on winners. They like to bet on a sure thing. Why? Because the majority of people are very risk adverse, and society has, in my opinion, has made them that way and docile, right? So they people don't want, for example, I'll use my parents as an example, and maybe to a larger extent, the baby boomer generation. They're at a place in their lives where the system has worked for them. They got what they were promised. They bought the house, right? The house is paid off. They've never run into financial troubles. They always had a steady job. Their wages kept up with inflation, right? They never had heavy debt loads.
That's a drastically different story for anybody under 40 years old.
Exactly. So, and that, what that does, it breeds different different psyches. People are going to be willing to take more risk when you're desperate a lot of the time, right?
Yeah, if you don't have a pension, you mentioned malls being designed in one way and used in another. The guy that created the 401k has a very similar story, where the 401k was picked up and it was meant to be like an addition to retirement plans and pensions, and it turned into the only thing that was there, and he was kind of flabbergasted by that. So yeah, that's definitely an interesting takeaway, and one I totally agree with. Another question that we got was from Max Goss, who said, what are your thoughts on market cycles and how they are relative to speculation versus these adoption and use case arguments? Which I think that's a great question, because when you talk about smart contracts, and you mentioned long-term versus short-term investments, this totally plays into that, at least in how I view it, because I may keep a small bag of something for a long time, like several years, but I could swing trade one in a matter of a week or 2 weeks or a month or 3 months or something like that from a pure investment perspective. So how do you look at that?
Well, it's just got what I look for is the media cycles. So if I see, for example, prices coming up to a key level, or say if it's Ethereum coming up to $1,000, or Bitcoin coming up to 10,000, or even 1,000 back then, I know that once that breaks, it's going to start a new cycle of money and interest coming in, because the media is going to be picking this up. And, well, you know, sadly, a lot of people still turn to the mainstream media for their news and investment advice, crazily enough. And that just creates a new wave of money, right? So I think that's understanding what kicks off a news cycle, and understanding that a new cycle is coming, and what that means, is going to help you position yourself quicker and more efficiently than most people who would not be aware of these things. So just knowing what the result of an action is going to be ahead of time is extremely valuable, and it's actionable, right? I think that's what's really the difference here. It's like, you get a lot of information from mainstream media that's in the past. You can't really act on it anymore, right? But this is type of information that if you understand ahead of time, you can actually do something about it and capitalize off of it, right? So that's the difference between actionable intel and information, insight, versus non-actionable.
Yeah, that's fascinating that you align a market cycle to a media market cycle as well. I certainly do from a price perspective.
And that's just my like 6 years of experience of watching this stuff speaking.
In terms of use cases and adoption that they were talking about, I think the better way to track that, if you're specifically looking at a singular project, would be how that project ranks in terms of market cap over time. So like if it works its way up from, you know, 500th in market cap or off the list and into the top 300, 200, 100, 50, 10, that's a better adoption metric than what its price relative to Bitcoin is, because in terms of relative to Bitcoin, most altcoins have massive market cycles where versus the dollar, they are consolidating, but Bitcoin's running. And then you have this horrible downward cycle that it looks like on the Bitcoin price chart. Like we saw pretty much all fall with alts being dead, they were relative to the dollar, they were flat or consolidating. And relative to Bitcoin, they were just getting wrecked. So that's how I personally look at it. So if you're looking for something that's growing, like in terms of use cases and adoption, I would look more at how it ranks on CoinMarketCap or something like that, or how many projects are using it, that type of thing.
I think there was a good, kind of like building on already what I was talking about. What was his name? Chris and Willie Wu. Again, I'll get the name, proper names and credit after. But they published an article describing the NAV. And that's basically a metric that measures and how you should and how I value these coins. Again, it's just around just their network effects. So you can see direct correlations, use Bitcoin or Ethereum as an example, to price versus the A, amount of users, and B, the amount of dollars actually being transacted on the network, right? Like anyone, a lot of people will point to, oh, transaction rate is rising. So, you know, people must be adopting to it. Well, that's not necessarily true. One person can be pumping out 1,000 transactions to pump that, right? But if that, it's different when you're actually putting skin into the game, right? Going back to that, your person isn't willing most of the time to be spending, you know, $1,000 per transaction constantly just to make it look like people are using the thing, right? Because there's a negative cost to you to that action that disincentivizes that. So, and that's kind of what a network fee is like there for, right? Is to prevent the spam and prevent that. Even though that gets abused clearly as well when fees are so low, right? I look at the dollars amount that are actually moving through the network, because that to me, it signals that people are confident with that network. You're not going to move $15 billion in 24 hours on something that has no proof of actually working or proof of securing those funds. Like, you're not going to deposit it into a bank with like 10 holes onto the public street, right? And no protection there, right? You're going to go with what's familiar and what has proven itself time and time again. And that's why, in my opinion, Bitcoin has a huge advantage over any competitor that comes in to compete directly with Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. Another person that I've seen create essentially a formula for trying to value an asset was Chris Bernisk.
That's the guy. That's him.
Yeah, Placeholder Ventures. He has a book on this that's where he has this equation that you're talking about. So I'll link that up. He did an interview with Laura Shin on Unchained. So another podcast that people can check out to learn more about that.
Yeah, I just want to clarify another thing, by the way. It's like these people are, yeah, they're the first to publish, but just because you're the first to publish doesn't mean it's specifically your idea. You're the first person to think of something, sure. Right? I just hear that a lot. But yeah, I want to give those guys credit where credit is due. And they've done great contributions to the community, and the data they provide is just absolutely priceless. So definitely give them a follow, check out their work, because it's worth your time. If you want to learn, like that, there's a good resource right there.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's been a challenge for these millions of new people that are getting involved is where do you start? And there are people that are extremely knowledgeable, but this space is relatively immature in terms of getting that information into the hands of new people to the space. So there's a lot of there's a knowledge deficit between what's out there and then what's available to the people looking to invest in it from a retail perspective.
For sure. And that's why I think there's huge, tremendous value in what you're providing here, for example, with this podcast, right? You build yourself as a trusted brand and reputation, and you can become a platform for helping these millions of people and directing them. Essentially, you know, creating the funnel.
Yeah. Well, don't give away my business model too quick.
If I had to give an example or where I direct people, that's lop.net/bitcoin.html. And it's created by a guy named Jameson Lopp. And the compilation he's put together here, you got the getting started, the documentaries, the online courses, the deep dive technicals. Like, if you just want to read the white paper, it's there. But if you want to really understand the technicals or how a Bitcoin transaction is actually created, what a UTXO is, like, the nitty and gritties, that's available there as well. If you just want general knowledge or, like, you know, keep up to the space with news and podcasts and discussion forums, it's all on there as well, right? Like, this, he's really done a great work of compiling all of the information. So it's my number one recommended place for new users.
I'll be pretty pumped if I can get him to include something that I create on there. So crypto goals, I guess.
I think we need to get you on there.
Yeah, I would love that. So I think if we close out, we're going to do one trading tip. So if you have a trading tip that you'd like to share with folks, then now's the time.
Yeah, so I think the number one thing you can do is, well, here's a few basic tips. Don't chase price. Always let it come to you. And even if the price breaks out, 9 times out of 10, it's going to come back and retest that breakout point. So for example, you just pull up a chart on Bitcoin and go back to when it was like pounding at 300 level, right? Or any of the Bitcoin pumps or anything really. Anytime the price moves above a key resistance level, you don't need to chase the breakout play. Just wait for the throwback. And what happens then is, so the price eventually will get sold down. And if the market really is bullish and you're looking for continuation in that move, place your bids on the former resistance of where the price broke out from, right? That's from an institutional level and a market maker's perspective. And like, as a trader, you only want to be placing bids and your sells on where liquidity is, right? Like, a lot of people, another issue that I see new traders making is that they're going to lump their orders into one order and hope that it hits, right? It's better to increase the probability of your orders getting hit and scale those orders. So for example, if I'm looking to buy something at $1, I'm going to be scattering my bids between, you know, 90 cents and $1.05 or 95 or $1, whatever your variance is, right? The point is that you're scattering your bids, increasing your probability of hitting, because it really sucks if you have your bids at 101 and it hits 102, 1 cent off, right? 102 or something. So this way you kind of just reduce the risk of missing your entries. And same thing works for your sells, right? It's nothing worse. It's probably worse. Yeah, it's probably worse than having your sells missed by a few bucks and then the price coming back at you for 100% than, you know, taking a little bit off. And yeah, that'd be another thing, is always take the price is going to be respect resistance and support more often than it's going to break it. So don't be the hero who's trying to add it resistance or support. Don't be the guy who's trying to anticipate, oh, well, this thing surely it has to break, right? I'm going to add right here. What confirmation has anything? There's no confirmation around that. That's just you hoping. Remove emotion altogether from your trading. And I think it's important. My biggest insight and revelation from trading is that anyone can learn the technicals of this. Anyone can spot horizontal resistance and support. It's just a matter of doing it 1,000 times, 10,000 times. You're going to get good at it. It's going to become second nature, just like any other learning process or task that humans move to go towards, right? But what's difficult is mastering your psychology. and being actually able to execute. Because as a trader, I can tell you, a new trader, there's nothing scarier than having the price collapsing in front of your eyes and they're getting close to your bids and you're wondering, oh my God, is this thing about to run right through me, right? Again, more often than not, price will respect where the liquidity is. And so if you just stick with your trade, have a trade plan, there's another tip. So many people enter a trade with, well, this looks great, hopefully it goes up. And then, you know, it goes up 2% and then you close out right away because behavioral economics says people love to realize gains. And the magnitude of a loss being felt emotionally and psychologically on your psyche is two and a half times greater than the realization of a win, right? People are chasing a chemical high and they're trying to avoid a chemical low, essentially is what's happening here. So if you can understand, like, you are going to learn so much about yourself as a person when you are trading and you actually put skin in the game. That's actually putting money into your trades.
That was excellent.
Yeah. And like I said, I have some great resources on that really dives into the psychology and how to master it and how to remove it. Like, your goal is, again, to remove the emotion from your trading. Act like a robot, be like water, remove emotional bias, don't care about the coin, only the price action and the trade plan, right?
Awesome. I'm going to append to what you said. You mentioned horizontal resistance and support. It's very difficult to draw yourself, or it's easy as you do it, but at first it can be difficult. So my tip will be a tool to help you do it. And I like mentioning it now because it's the beginning of the year. So this is an exciting time for people that are pivot traders. There's a technical indicator if someone uses TradingView, and it's just called pivots. It's built in. And by default, if you enable this, it creates horizontal resistance points that are based on previous price action. And it predicts it out into the future based on price, and then it gives you resistance and supports. By default, it sets that on a monthly basis. But because this is a new year, if you change that to a yearly basis for older assets, you could actually look at it in a yearly sense. Bitcoin blasted through R1 through 5, which are the five resistances that it creates by default, blasted through all five last year, which was, like, if you look at this in a traditional asset, it's incredible. And so those have been newly printed for the year. And if something that you're looking at is old enough, then you can look at yearly pivots. But if not, if you're just looking at what's your resistance on a weekly basis or something like that, you can turn it on weekly and look at what potential resistance would be for the week ahead or what potential support would be if it fails. So my tip is a simple indicator to help you start identifying some of those horizontal support and resistance zones.
Yeah, automate the process until you can just do it yourself without even thinking. And you will get to that point. You will. As long as you're willing to put in the time and the effort and commit to this, you will figure this stuff out. I guarantee it.
Yeah, and that's another reason why I really enjoyed and latched on to what Josh got me onto with the Ichimoku system, because while looking at those, you know, the clouds and stuff is a little challenging at first. Once you do, then you just don't have to draw anything, you know, and you let the system take over for you. So yeah, also the Ichimoku cloud system, which is a Japanese system that is great. I'll always link those up in the show notes, so check those out. Nick, this has been fantastic. We're well over time, but I think people will have found great value in it. So I appreciate you being here, and I hope you'll join me again someday. And where can people find you, whether it's on Twitter or website, whatever, to say thank you, or if they have follow-up questions or anything like that?
Yeah, well, thanks again. Thanks for having me, man. I love to get out there and share what I've learned in these past 6 years, and hopefully people can heed my mistakes and hopefully avoid them, and they can speed up the their learning and understanding of this space and learn it and be able to make money from it quicker than I did. And you can follow me on Twitter. I have a large social media presence there at MBTC Pizpie. And you can also get in touch with me on Telegram at BitPy. And I'm pretty responsive. Just if you have any questions or anything, just shoot me a follow and send me a DM.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And we will catch y'all next time.
Thank you. Monuments crumble.